Ah, my name is still Mildred, and I'm still an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. This is not my favorite thing to do, but since I was asked to do it, I do it willingly. And I won't be lengthy. I find it hard to pick. Dick said, take something from your life that's a gift. So I'll do that. Something that has been a great deal of help to me. It's not humorous, it's not none of, but you might find it helpful. First, I want to tell you a little story, though, of something that happened to me that kind of has had an influence on me. In May, one night, I was preparing for a big social event that I plan and organize for teachers. And I was all excited and had a late supper and was carrying a tray with some dishes on it, had finished my supper, and it had a plate on it, and I'm saying this, in a Pyrex dish, and a cup, and another dish, and a paring knife, and a spoon and a fork. And I slipped because I wasn't paying attention and banged my head on the door. And as is my wont, thought, well, I'm okay, I'll get up. And as I opened my eyes, realized there was blood all over. In the accident and in the fall, the paring knife was sticking in my throat. And as is my wont, I'm going to fix it. My place looked as if it was a war zone, because I was like, there was blood all over. And finally, I thought, well, I'm just going to, you know, hold it. And there was no holding it. So I had the good sense to get to the phone and call the ambulance. And they were there in about 12 minutes and took me to the hospital. And I got sewed up and was home in 3 hours. And in a sense, the reason I think about it once in a while, the night that it happened, I just think sometimes the things that happen to us in sobriety, I don't really know what the message is. I don't even know really why I'm telling you this, except it was an important evening to me. You know, when the doctor got to me, she said, you have a very good guardian angel. And if that's the advantage of having wrinkles, you can't so much see my scar. If you look long enough, you'll find good in everything. It has been more frightening to me after it happened than it was the night it happened. The night it happened, I was calm as a cucumber. I have a little mantra that I say a lot. God, I know you're here. And that's the first thing that came to mind, and I was as cool as a cucumber, really, through the whole thing. My singing voice has been somewhat affected, but at least I'm here and I'm alive and I can still speak. So that's my story. So I guess there's work for me to do here. God isn't done with me yet. The thing I want to share with you that has been really influential, I have been changed a great deal. I was going to say I have changed. I don't think that's the way it goes. I think God grows our souls. And I have been changed a great deal by something that I learned. And as I give retreats and talk about this, I find out that a lot of people don't know this. I didn't know it. I'm well educated. I didn't know this. I didn't know about the stuff that is buried in the unconscious. When I was 21 years sober, that's when I retired from my teaching career, and I spoke about that this this morning, I won't get into that again, but that's when it really hit me. It had been escalating inside me, that there was something not right within me, and I didn't know what to do about it. I didn't feel at home often in AA. I hear people say they came into AA and, you know, they just kind of knew they were no longer alone. I did not have that experience. I often felt alone. I often felt, I'm not okay, there's something wrong. And despite all the work that I had done, that wasn't relieved. And I didn't know what to do about it. And one day I was at a conference, and there was a man there who talked about a business that he had started. And he said it was a strange sort of thing that though the business was well structured, it was not successful. And he had brought in management consultants, and they said the business, I don't know, we don't understand why it's not being successful. And through that process, he said he learned about the bondage of self. And I heard it. I don't know if anybody else that night heard it. He was talking, he said, about old messages that he carried from childhood. And that's about all he said at the conference. We had a little talk, he and I, afterwards, and he said, you know, that he realized that the thing that was holding him back was something he had learned in childhood. You know, and oftentimes I think we discount that and we think, well, get over it, don't think about that. But that's the stuff that's buried in the unconscious, and what was buried in his unconscious was his father saying to him, nothing ever is going to work out for you, you'll never be successful, that kind of thing. Now, it seems that I'm not going to go into a big explanation. I'm just telling you something that has changed my life. I heard that, and I remembered the days when I was a little girl, and I learned nobody cares about me. I'm not okay. Something is wrong. My brothers and sisters who love me, I've asked them to fix Dora, and they're not doing it. And there must be, they don't care about me. And that's what I never understood why I always felt on the outside, why I always seemed to be chasing somebody. Why don't you love me? I think about being a little girl chasing across the playground and saying to these little girls, why don't you love me? I'm a nice little girl. Why don't you want to play with me? And I never knew how to process that and, you know, make that work. It was an amazing thing. After that conference and that conversation with that man, somebody put a tape into my hands. And guess what? It was a man talking about the stuff buried in the unconscious. And then I traced that man down, and I found out that he was teaching classes. And so I followed him, and I came to the States for 2 weeks, and I learned what this business is, that how that stuff gets buried in the unconscious. The way I see it today, it is the voice of the false self. And I, you know, have learned about how to deal with that, to ask the power that is within me to take that away. And it has changed my energy completely, absolutely completely. You know, you can't get away from the energy you put out. The HeartMath solution has taken a picture of the energy field that is around us, that comes from the way we think inside and the way we feel and what we put out. And they say there's an 8-foot donut of energy around us, and that we read each other's energy. And I won't say much more than that. I don't want this to be a down. I'm sure Clancy will have many things to say. But I can tell you, that's my gift to you. If there's one person out there who knows, who understands, who knows what I'm talking about and has some of that stuff buried, that's what I really have found has been a lot of my spiritual work, because how do you get to know what's down there? We trigger each other's stuff. That's what happens. One minute life feels good and the next minute I'm all upset. Why? Because that's the nature of the resonance and the way we deal with each other. And I know today what to do about it. And if anybody wants to talk to me about that, I'm always happy to talk about that, because that to me has been one of the defining moments, or one of the defining experiences. It was a gift to me, and that's my gift to you tonight. Thank you.
Did you ever think one of those people that, back when you were a real pain in the ass, was wishing you would slit your throat, and if the prayer finally became true? That's kind of Clancy-like. I don't know where the hell that came. I'm bobbing. I know. I'm bobbing. I'm an alcoholic. It's been a nice weekend. There's this personality of these different events, and this is a gentleness and a, as Dick said, a family environment. It feels like family. It feels close. It's a really nice, it's a very receptive group of people to communicate with, and it's been very nice. Glad to be here. It's been very pleasant. The talks have all been wonderful. A few times ago when I was at Clancy, we were talking about, as you get older, and Clancy's older than I am by a fair amount. But as you get older and you start losing not only your heroes, but you start losing your running buddies. I've had 7 or 8 deaths this year, attended a couple of memorial services. And, you know, your husband, John, and Sandy, and different people. Three years ago, I lost my spiritual advisor and my sponsor in the same year. And when you go to turn around and talk to most people, they don't know who the heck you're talking about. You know, you mentioned Norm Alpie, or you mentioned, you know, Jack Brennan, or whoever you're talking about, they don't know. It's like part of it is what happens to couples who have been married a long time, and you lose one of the, you know, you lose your spouse. And that shared bank of memory, you know, Linda is the repository of so much family information. I know my children's names, but I have trouble with their ages and birthdays and where they live, that sort of stuff. When I came in, I knew quite a number of people who got sober in the 40s. And now, when you look around and you talk about, you know, people who got sober in the 50s are rare. I was thinking today, if I were Clancy, but even myself, I noticed, when I first started going to roundups or conventions, the talks were so different. If I would take a lot of those old talks and play them for you, I was Clarence Roberts, or I was going to, you know, you take all those old-fashioned talks. They started with the first drink, they ended with their last, and they took 5 minutes at the end of the talk about kids, wife, and job. And if you could hear the music, it included most of what we talk about today. It was there, but you had to be able to hear the music. It was like listening to the story of Christmas. It was, you know. And then I think more than anybody else, there were always a few people that started including recovering in their talks, the chief of which, in my book, was Chuck Chamberlain. I think almost single-handedly, in my book, he changed the communication in Alcoholics Anonymous, but Cecil and Mac and different people started to include talking about the steps, running the steps in their talk. And that shifted. That was kind of like the second generation, in my experience, the second generation of the community. We're an oral society. We're a story society. And that was the second generation of the talks. And it seems like the third generation, because people started to get sober earlier, people started to say, now what? You know, I got sober when I was 25, not 45. Now what? And you never heard anything critical. If a person was in the program doing their best and staying sober, they were a success. You know, so today we start to eke in that if you're not doing it a certain way, maybe you're not quite as good member of AA as someone else is a member of good, you know, of AA. You're starting to be the right way to do it and the not so right way to do it. And I guess there's always been a sort of right way to do it, but the right way to do it is to begin it as a serious endeavor in your life. And there are people who come from a very flawed background. Some of those people didn't have the tools that some of the other people who didn't have some of the handicaps that they dragged into the room would do. And it's a very hard thing to judge someone else's program and what they're doing. And to come to a conference like this, or to conferences like it, the workshops, there were no workshops. You know, there was no, you might have a conversation about sponsorship, but there wasn't the detail in which we go, you know, you do an hour and 10 minutes on a step. That's a paragraph in the book, or 2 pages in the book. The instructions in the book are very clear, and they're very simple. They're very deep, and they're very profound, so we never exhaust the quality and the depth of the steps. You ever notice we never have arguments about the steps? We argue about the tradition, but have you ever been to a meeting where anybody argues about a step? I've never been to a meeting where that's true. You ever been to a meeting where someone said you broke the step? We talk about breaking traditions, but we don't talk about, you know, because we treat them like rules and laws. But we don't have the arrogance to be able to say, well, you know, you just bought a new car and you have made your amends. What the hell are you, you know, we don't go to people and have that conversation, because none of us are exhausting. None of us live so well that we exhaust the depths of the steps and would have the arrogance to be able to call someone on their imperfect participation in the program, because our, you know, who isn't imperfect in that process? The great, and I think there's a little bit of a danger as we get fancier and as we get more detailed, as we get more didactic, as we get more orthodox with the book, that we can go too far, that we carry this idea that this is the correct way. The positive application of spiritual principles and spiritual ideas is always powerful. The negative application of spiritual principles is always the husk. It's of little or no value. So to be able to use or compare is an agenda of the ego. It's not the agenda of the spirit. It is, we're all accessing a power that we don't control, and we're all here by the grace of God. Can you imagine, I mean, if we took 5 minutes, there's a lot of sobriety in this room, and said, where would you be if you never got sober? What would your family be like? What would your children be like? You know, I mean, it just be devastating. I mean, the gratitude, the grace by which we're all in this room. If we get too detailed, if we get too scientific, if we get too technical, I think we have some danger of taking that process too far. Joe and Charlie, in my book, created a renaissance with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we needed that renaissance in our fellowship. And each of us, depending upon what your proclivity is, you can take that investigation process, you can take the application process to whatever your own spiritual personality is. I mean, you can be as detailed as you want to be, and you can be as deep as you want, can be, or you can be as simple as you want to be. And for many people today, the religion of the world is psychology. And we also, you know, when I came in, you could look up in a couple of pages of the yellow pages, you know, all the psychiatrists and psychologists, and today it's an industry, you know, between the medications that people are getting and between all the counselors and the psychologists. It's very helpful, can be very important, can be life-changing for many of us in these rooms. But psychology does not have the power to bring us to recovery. It might be able to get you in the front door. But psychology, as a friend of mine once said, is like transferring the bomb from your seat of your pants to under your chair. It isn't deep enough for the healing. The insight's important and the insight's helpful, but self-knowledge is not going to get this job done. There's what we need is something that's at a much deeper level, and it's a spiritual level. But we need to have some balance in that process, and we need to have a kindness and a compassion in that process. And so much for my soapbox. If I had one gift, and I've had so many that it would be hard for me, my wife would be one of the gifts. My parents would be one of the gifts. But with respect to this program, it would have been my sponsor, Warren McGinley. My sponsor was a powerful, ordinary guy. He was a mailman. He was lost half his crew in Italy in a bomb disposal unit. Those men never talked about the war. Bob White, another guy that was vitally important in my recovery. I'm having lunch with Bob White one time with Buck Newsom, and Buck says, "Hey, Bob, we can get free license plates." I say, "What do you mean free license plates?" "Well, they give free license plates to prisoners of war." Now, I knew known him for quite some time. I didn't know he was a prisoner of war. You know, so White's in an airplane over Germany bombing. They shoot his airplane down. He gets his crew out. His chute's on fire. He gets down there. He gets in a fist fight with the Germans that capture him, and he's in a prisoner of war camp for a couple of years. And at the end of the war, he's afraid they're going to kill him, bury all the people. And he and a guy, security got a little lax, so he and a guy took off and escaped. And these two guys slept during the day in the woods and ran at night. And finally, they were starving to death, and they figured they just couldn't do it anymore. And they went into a town in northern Germany and turned themselves in, and the town surrendered to them. The town wanted to be in the hands of Americans rather than the Russians, who would have mowed everybody down in the goddamn town. And then German soldiers started to come in and turn their arms in, and Bob and this guy, you know, Bob takes drunk, and there happened to be a reporter, so they wrote it up in the Army newspaper. And today, if he were on the, you know, on this traveling menagerie of circuit speakers, that would be a tall pole in the tent of his story and nothing, something that he never mentioned. Those guys never talked about the war until they got really old. And then some of that stuff would come out. My sponsor didn't talk about the war much until the last, you know, 5 or 6 years of his life. I don't know how many lives he touched, but it would be a couple of hundred. He was a 12-step champion of the Uptown group of Alcoholics Anonymous. You would not have had him in this room talking to you about a seminar in the Big Book. He was my Big Book. His wife, they were just, in the 42 and a half years we had him as my sponsor, never did we make a call to say, could we come over, with kids, without kids, fighting, not fight, never in that time. You know, we'd be over at his house. It was an AA house. And he brought me through the steps in a very much simpler way than the way we go through the steps today. It was, you know, he had me take the first 3 steps sitting in my chair in an AA meeting, kind of more or less taking me through the fact that I had taken those first 3 steps. He helped me with my 4th step, and he helped me with my 8th step and 9th. But that was mostly, and in our country, all we ever talked about were the steps. Our steps, all our meetings were closed step discussion meetings. So we had a lot of discussion about the steps. But this powerful, ordinary guy was a life changer. It was like E.T. He just went around lighting people's pilot lights. You know, just bringing them to a meeting, hooking them up with the right person, taking them through, you know, You didn't take them through the book, but you went, you know, you usually got assistance with the amends steps, and you got assistance with the fourth step. And the power, all things that are strongly spiritual, at their essence, are deeply simple. They're profound. They're life-changing, but they're simple. And I think that's part of the encouragement as we get, and the fact that most of us are getting sober earlier and we're in sobriety for a very long period of time. And it isn't surprising that we want a thorough discussion about the application of these principles in our lives. I'm not, you know, I'm one of the guys that complicates it, so I'm not, you know, a critic of that complication. But I also want to notice that it's simple. And you don't need a master's degree to do the steps. And there's plenty of people who, there's a hell of a lot of people out there that have done the work and their lives have been transformed and they couldn't tell you about it. And there's a lot of people, you know, I mean, for the people who get up and do this, you know, to do this well, you probably have to have done the work, because we don't suffer phonies very easily in Alcoholics Anonymous. That would probably come through. You have to do the work, and then you have to be able to see what you've done. And then if you've seen what you've done and you have the ability to communicate, that's probably why you end up behind a podium on a regular basis in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's... But in essence, the great power for me of Alcoholics Anonymous is that we have access to a deeply powerful spiritual program, which is practical and simple. We have things to do. We have people to help. Thank you.
My name is Clancy Imeslin, and I'm an alcoholic. I was sitting there when Bob was talking earlier today, and he told two jokes. Now, I have no jokes to tell you, but I have had a couple of experiences that may cheer you up. About a month ago, I was in Chicago, and I had to speak that night, and that killed Saturday. No football games on to watch yet. I guess it must have been 2 months ago. And I took a walk through a mall, and I saw a sign that said, Muslim Books. I thought, what in the world would Muslim Books be? So I went in there, and they had a bunch of racks of books in Arabic, and then one rack in English. I was looking through that. And this little snotty little guy came up to me and said, well, he said, may we sell you something? And I said, yes, I'm looking for that book by Donald Trump that deals with how to handle illegal Muslims in the United States causing trouble. He said, you son of a bitch, get out and stay out. I said, that's the one. But I was gracious enough to say, do you have it in paperback? Most of us know Sandy Beach. This is actually happened when the year he was dying. I happened to be in Tampa talking, so I went over to spend the afternoon with him, and we laughed and talked about people and judged people who weren't there, and had a lot of fun. And he said, "Oh, Clancy, I had the damnedest dream last night. I dreamt I had died and gone to hell. I was in front of the pearly gates, and St. Peter wouldn't let me in." And I said, "Why won't you let me in?" He said, "Well, it's nothing personal. You're just not on my list." I said, "But I'm a friend of Bill Wilson." "He's not on there either." So that puts things back in context, I guess. I'd like to talk a little bit about... I came to my first AA meeting in 1949, long before I was sober. And I grew up in Wisconsin, and I'm still in a flush of happiness over the 65-yard pass that won the game for us the other night. But this is the signal for applause. This is the signal for muffled sobs. But I grew up in Wisconsin, and I was a bright little boy raised in a good church, the Norwegian Lutheran Church, very strict, very firm. And I got put ahead in school at Christmas time from one grade to the next because I could read well. And I remember my grandma telling me that you're going to become governor of Wisconsin someday, and I was pleased to hear that. And I was getting straight A's in school, doing very well. And my parents got divorced when I was about 12. Now, that doesn't sound like much, does it? Everybody gets divorced. But at the age of 12, I had never heard of a divorce. There'd none in our church, none in our family, none ever. And they explained it to me, but I felt very betrayed by my parents somehow. And I stopped trying. And by the time I was 15, I was flunking out of high school, didn't care about anything. And the only thing that saved my bacon was that the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And that was so impressive to me that it held my attention and made me decide to run away and get terrible revenge on the Japanese people. And when I was 15, I ran away from home and hitchhiked to San Francisco. And I couldn't get the Marine Corps, obviously, which I was going to try to do, but I got the Merchant Marine, and I was on a ship, and I had my 16th birthday in Pearl Harbor. And my family thought I was up in northern Wisconsin visiting my aunt. But I got in the war early, when I was 17, I stopped and went over and enlisted in the Navy. The end of the war, I was a naval hospital up in Northern California being sewed together. And took some tests. I've always been great on tests. And those tests enabled me to go back to Wisconsin as I just finished my sophomore year in high school and go to the university as a freshman. And I went to the university and all those years I didn't drink. The guys I sailed on ships with drank, but I thought they were just terrible because it didn't taste good and they acted bad. But when I got into college, the veterans kind of flocked together at night, going out and do things. And so I went with them rather than the high school kids. And I got to learn drink a little bit. I tried to force myself to drink a little bit. And somewhere in my first year of college, I crossed an invisible line in which now drinking was something I looked forward to. It brought me comfort and pleasure. It made me feel like something. And that started my drinking. And I drank for several years. As I say, I went to somebody sent me to an A meeting in 1949, and I thought it was stupid. And I went to A meetings from then on. Every time I got fired off a job, I'd go to an A meeting, so it looked as though I was trying to do something. And I was quite a successful writer intermittently, but then my drinking would, sooner or later they'd call me and say, "Clancy, you write very well," and I'd, "Thank you. But we really need you here Mondays, too. And Tuesdays, we come in, you smell bad." And I went to AA off and on, and AA was one of the two great things that bothered me about AA were this: I'm not really an alcoholic. And even if I am, I can't return to God because it's too, I'm too stained. And that last one stayed with me. I remember I was working in Texas, and at that time I was going through a period where when I got to a certain stage of drinking, I'd go out and counsel police officers. Dumb. But I'd go to jail overnight. And I was in jail one night, and I got out, and my neighbor was there to pick me up, and I said, "You shouldn't have come down here. I got this guy's badge number. I'm going to get his ass." He really abused me. He said, "I don't know about that." He said, "What, you're drunk last night? Your little son died and we couldn't find you." That just about wiped me out. I had a bunch of little girls and one little boy. And I felt so bad. We took him up to Wisconsin and buried him next to his grandmother in a little country churchyard where 2 years ago I buried my wife so she could be with her little boy. And I had a really feeling. I remember cursing God. "God, you killed my little boy that never committed a sin in his life to punish me. because I'm bad. Well, screw you, God. You'll get me in hell, but I won't have anything to do with you till then. Screw you. And I'd go to A and hear how just turn your life over to God. That's ridiculous. And so I had a difficult time. And I almost, I went to the insane asylum once as a suicide. I was in jail a lot. I was just foreign to the world. And I tried to find some answer. But I'd sit and think a lot. And I'm sure most of you have done that. Sometimes sit in an idle hour and just examine yourself. And why am I, what's wrong with me? And I knew what was wrong with me, and I didn't dare tell anybody, because it's such a sickening little thing. I'm too sensitive. That's what you tell people that, and that's what they do. They laugh. You're too sensitive, huh? But I feel things too intensely. And alcohol is not my problem. Alcohol is one of the few things that assuage that feeling. It makes me, gets rid of that feeling, makes me feel like I'm strong and together, and if I don't, I get to become a whimpering nothing. And I always do that. I have a problem with alcohol because it put me in jail a lot of times and this here and there. But my problem is that I drink too much. If I just find a way to stop once I start feeling good, then I'd be home free. And I tried that for a long time. I remember after I got sober this time, I was talking to my I got a sponsor who was an actor in the movies. And I thought, I'll hustle him for a few bucks and get out of town. But he got to me. He got inside my head, much to my surprise. But I asked him one time, I said, Bob, why is it how many times I came home from work and determined to stop and have two drinks, and then go home, have dinner with my family? And I'd go stop for two drinks, and all of a sudden I'd look up, it's 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night again. How can that happen? And he said, he gave me an answer that helped me understand my nature, my problem. He said, kid, the guy wanted to be home at 2 for dinner, he had two drinks and he went away. And the guy wanted a night full of fun came in and jumped in your body. And that certainly was true. And I began to understand a little bit about, I remember talking to my sponsor and asking him, but I go to these meetings and all they talk about is how much they drink or they compete with their drinking. And if it isn't that, they're talking about God and I don't like either one of them. He said, well, you don't know much about alcoholism. You haven't picked up much. But the nature of the problem is this. We are not fighting alcohol at all. We are fighting alcoholism. And alcoholism is not the same as an alcohol problem. If you have an alcohol problem, you don't need AA. If there was just an alcohol problem, there'd be no AA. We'd just all quit and go home. He said, but the curse of alcoholism is this. It is too good for you. It does too much for you. It makes you feel that nothing else does. It makes you feel secure and good. He said, and that's even that in itself is not the problem. But sooner or later you drink too much, so you quit. And then you discover the sad part of life, that sobriety becomes more painful than drinking. And all of a sudden you start being obsessed and you can't sleep very well and things are tough and you think about all the sadness in life. And eventually the time comes when you have to drink to preserve your sanity. And I think about that. When my son died, I felt so bad that I swore off once and for all. And it got so bad that one day I just went in the garage and hooked up a hose on the car and turned the motor and went to sleep and died. It got so bad, I was crazy. I'd gotten up in the morning and just get a cup of coffee. And there was no coffee made. And there's a note on the dining room table. I've taken the group of kids to church. Make some coffee. I thought, well, screw this. This is the end of it. I wanted to kill myself over that. And people later said, why did you kill yourself? Well, I said, I didn't have any coffee. Which is about the reason we have here, you know. Why did you do that? The reasons we have are so flimsy that we have to make up reasons why we made us drink enough. And so the greatest thing I learned in my early months of sobriety, I learned little by little the nature of my problem. The nature of my problem was not alcohol, it was alcoholism. I remember, he made it sound so easy and understandable. And I could grasp it, because I was pretty smart, but my defenses were always against all this panoply and nonsense. But I remember thinking one time, if what he says is true, and I think the moment he said this, it seemed to put a nail in the coffin. He said, I said, but my problem really isn't alcohol. He said, no, alcoholics aren't people whose problem is alcohol. Alcoholics are people whose answer is alcohol. If it's your answer, you're screwed for the rest of your natural life. And I thought, that I understand that. My answer has been alcohol. And I got to find a way around it, but I can't stand to stay sober. Remember, one of the great turning spots in my life is I decided on a temporary basis turn over my will and my life to my sponsor. And I did that because I could not return to God. I remember telling my sponsor that. He said, we're going to go through the steps now. I said, I can't return to God. He says, why not? I said, well, I told him why. I said, I've always had a problem with God. I've always believed in God, but I know that he is not the type of object that most people think he is, a loving, kindly God. He's a malicious, punishing God. And he said, well, you're lucky because in AA, we are never asked to return to God. I said, of course we are. What are you talking about? But to a power greater than myself, is that supposed to fool me? He said, no, read the step over on the wall. We came to believe in something. You start from where you are and you come to believe in something. Can't you believe in a loving God? And I said, no. He said, can't you believe in Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, I like it better than I used to, but not much. He said, do you think I'm doing better than you are? I said, of course you are. He said, congratulations. I'm your new higher power. And I could accept that because I knew he was trying to help me. And I was living in the back seat of an abandoned car in a parking lot, cold and sick every night, hungry, cold, desperate. But little by little, I started to come to believe in, I believed in him. And the moment changed my life, I think. There was a woman in AA named Happy Austin. She lives in my memory. And I hated her. I hated her. I wanted to kill her until I saw her. She kept bad-mouthing me and telling girls I'm not worthy and things like that. I thought, I'll kill that bastard. And I got to the meeting one night, and there was my sponsor, and there was Happy Austin. And she was holding court with her friends if she had any friends. He said, I want you to apologize to Happy. I said, apologize to Happy? For what? He said, well, last night at the Monday night meeting, you called her a bitch. I said, Bob, she is a bitch. He said, why do you think she's a bitch? Because she told Margaret to stay away from him, and Margaret's one of the few girls I've ever loved. And he said, I'll tell you what, I don't want to hear it. You go over and apologize to Margaret, to Happy. And that day, I remember my mind saying, enough of this phony AA crap, this psychoanalysis nonsense, this baloney, incompetent people giving incompetent advice to people who are more competent than they are. This is ridiculous. I'm getting out of here. Once and for all. But unfortunately, my feet were honest. And then sorry I called you a bitch. You bitch. When I look back and think about that, that's the moment I accepted Alcoholics Anonymous. I allowed someone to superimpose a terrible thing over my brain that I didn't want to do, and I did it. And after that, it got a lot easier. And but I could never quite accept the concept of God. My sponsor was still my higher power when he died. And how do you get a new sponsor? I got this guy, Chuck Chamberlain. And I didn't know it at the time, but I was the only one he ever sponsored, he said. But I was afraid to go to him because he's such a religious freak. I'd have to go to Vespers every night or something, some hideous thing. But I, on the Sunday afternoon on my seventh birthday in 1965, I was speaking at the Southern California Convention in a Sunday afternoon meeting. My wife was there and a couple guys sponsored. And I drove home. Everybody on the program I sponsored. I sponsored the leader. I sponsored the 2 10-minute speakers. I sponsored everybody. And on the way home, I was driving. I had a good job. I thought, I'm really doing well. I'm really doing well. My family's returned to me after several years. I've got a good job. I'm doing great. But I don't have a sponsor. What would I do if I really had a big, bad trouble? I don't know what I'd do, because I went through the list of names, and I knew something bad about everybody. And I thought, well, who's ahead of me that's more active than I am? There's only one person, Chuck Chamberlain. He was really active, I'll tell you. So I got home to my house that night, and I called him in Laguna Beach. I said, Chuck, this is Clancy Emerson. I'd like to come down and see you in your office tomorrow. And he said, well, that'll be fine. He told me how to get there. By the time I got there, the next morning, I didn't feel much like asking him. But we sat down, and I said, you know, I was thinking about coming down here and asking you to be my sponsor. He said, really? I was in Bakersfield and had heard you talk yesterday, and I thought you were coming down to offer me mine. Now, he's a rotten enough son of a bitch for me. So he became my sponsor, and in the course of his... He never gave me any direction. I would have died if he'd been my sponsor when I was new, because my sponsor when I was new said, do this, do that, don't do that, do this, go here, don't go there. But Chuck just told me showed me by example. And thank God I'd done enough things for my first sponsor so that I was doing better. And one day he said to me, I never hear you talk about God much. I said, Chuck, God hates me, and I hate God. He said, really? He said, I got some bad news for you. I said, what's that? He said, you're not important enough for God to hate. I thought about that afterwards. I thought, I got to hope that's true. And I said a prayer that day. I said, thank you, God, for keeping me sober. And I've never gone to sleep since then without saying that prayer. But eventually I had to evolve a concept of God that I could break through to. And I cannot gather the simplicity of people like my friend who died, who just kept saying, just turn your life over to God. How do you do that? That's like saying, how do I get an elephant sandwich? Cut something off your elephant's leg. You know, it doesn't make sense. And I Sandy always had a great, easy path. Turn it over to God. Got a problem? Turn it over to God. And that sounds very nice, but see down deep, how do you do it? How do you do it? And so over the years, I worked through the steps and worked with newcomers, and that enhanced my knowledge of the steps because you had to keep teaching them things. And that, over the years, I looked at it, I don't know when exactly what happened, but I think I seized upon the 11th step as something I could really believe and follow. In that, every night when I pray, I thank God for keeping me sober. But I pray for knowledge of his will for me and the power to carry it out. If I can find that, I don't need anything else. I think it desecrates God to say, God, find me a parking spot. Get me a girl. Get me a job. I don't know that God really cares. But I believe that there's a pattern to existence, a pattern of life. And if I get in that pattern, I'll do well. And if I fight against it, I won't. And every night I try to go over my life and think, did I hurt someone today? Did I act badly? Did I act in a way that shamed God or no? And no one ever becomes perfect around here. But I thought, I've done that, and tonight, for the, 10,000th straight night, I will pray to God and ask Him for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry it out. So I want tomorrow morning when I get up, I can face the world without it carrying a load of guilt and fear and despair that I've carried for so many years. And Alcoholics Anonymous to me is such a wonderful thing because now a lot of people, because I laugh and joke a lot, they say, I don't take it seriously. It's the most serious thing in my life. But I also don't want to become somber. One of the great phrases of that whole book, we are not a glum lot. But you get in church, you get the same thing. Like on Sunday morning at convention, they say, our spiritual speaker. They're all spiritual speakers. The day you talk doesn't make much difference. Whether it's Sunday morning, that's when church is outside of AA, but that doesn't make a spiritual speaker. Some speakers are spiritual, some aren't. But I know this, that I want to enjoy life. I want to have the pleasure of life. My wife and I were married 63 years. She was married 63 years. I was married about 48. But one of the great reasons, we were going to break up several times, but we did one thing, and I'm so glad I did it. We did it. That is, we stayed together for the sake of the children. Because I always, to me, going back to my childhood, I was the only child of a broken family, and I felt bad about that for 25 years after that. I still do in a way. And I wanted my children to have a home where there's mom and dad and dog and cat. And as a result of that, my daughters have all grown up. I'll tell you how you know you're old. My daughters are now retiring from their jobs. My oldest daughter's a judge. She's retiring. My second oldest daughter was the head of the biology department at the University of New Mexico. She just retired. Her sisters talked her into coming to my house and being my housekeeper. So she cooks for me now, and we have a nice relationship. But the greatest thing about my family, all of my kids get along with each other, and they all love me, it seems to me. And it's such a nice thing. And they're all, three of my daughters are sober 26 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never knew that any of them drank. They'd come home for Christmas and say, do you mind if we keep a bottle of wine in the refrigerator? I said, no. And so they always had an excuse why they smelled like booze. But they were drinking a lot, I guess. When my youngest daughter, Susan, finally got to, I talked to her about, she's the one that married the guy that I didn't like her to marry. She divorced him finally and married another guy that's really a nice guy. And I said to her husband, I can't believe she's an alcoholic. She says, I do. I come home from meeting, she's passed out on the sofa. She doesn't know if she put the kids to bed or what she's done or anything. And so they're all alcoholics, I guess, but they're all sober. And I live an interesting life. I'm 88 years old, and everybody I ever know that's 88 has been in a hospital somewhere, feeble or goofy. And my grandfather got to be 88 and he had thick glasses. And I don't know what, but the great thing about being 88, every day you woke, I read in the paper a few months ago that every day 1,500 World War II veterans die on the average. So I look at the paper every morning, see if I made it. But I know some morning I won't. But I'll have a wonderful memory of a good life because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people I found here. Thank you.